Good morning and welcome. It is 10 o'clock on Saturday. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3, which means it's time for Final Draft, books, writing and literary culture, every weekend, helping you discover what you want to read, your next favourite read. And it's the last Saturday of the month, which means we're going back and rediscovering an Australian classic in the Australian Classics Book Club. I will be joined, as always, by David Winter. He is a senior publisher at Text Publishing, the wonderful company that bring us the Australian classics. And I'm also joined today by Deborah Adelaide. She is an Australian author, and we are going to be discovering Mina Calthorpe's The Dye House, looking back to Sydney's inner west in the 1950s, and a time when society was very much shifting, workers' rights were shifting, and the world was really just rediscovering itself after the Second World War. It's a fantastic novel. It's actually, as I was reading it this week, it emerged as probably my favourite of the Australian classics that we've revisited so far. So I can't wait to share it with you. We are about to take a short break, but stay tuned. I'll be back with David and with Deborah sharing Mina Calthorpe's The Dye House in the Australian Classics Book Club.
UTS is number one again. Ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row. As a truly modern university, we never look back. By continually challenging conventions, we not only change the status quo, we improve it. Join us for a course info evening. For options, dates and other details, go online and search for UTS Course Info Night. UTS, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Good morning. You are listening to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and it is that time of the month again when we revisit, or visits perhaps for the first time, an Australian classic in the Australian Classics Book Club. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined in the book club, as I am every month, by David Winter. David is a senior editor at Text Publishing, and we also have in the book club a new guest, Deborah Adelaide. Deborah is a novelist, she's a writer and an academic. Her works include Serpent Dust, The Hotel Albatross, and The Women's Pages. David, Deborah, look, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me in the book club this month.
Good morning, Andrew. Thank you.
Hi, Andrew. Pleasure.
And this month we're discussing what I'm going to confess has emerged as probably my favourite so far. We've got Mina Calthorpe's The Dye House. And as I read it, I started getting into this narrative that's very close to where I live, and then it took me away. But before we get too much into the narrative, David, can you give us a little bit of an idea of who Mina Calthorpe was?
Sure, Andrew. Well, she was born in 1905 in Goulburn to a very large family, and she was educated there, grew up and became a school teacher. And during the Depression, she married a fellow called Bill Calthorpe, and they moved to Sydney. And at that point, she began to work in a number of jobs. And I have a delightful Australian Women's Weekly article that came out around the time of the Dye House being published, where it lists the various jobs that she worked in. She was a machinist in a corset factory, a cake decorator in a cake shop, a clerk in an engineering store, a fruit picker in the Riverina, and she worked in the office of a dye house, which of course informed this novel. So she was someone who worked all of her life, and she didn't really become a published author until she was 56. So it's something that we've seen quite a bit in the classics, that there are authors who blossom late in life. She belongs to a left-wing post-war social realist tradition, I think, and in that sense we can see her book The Dye House in the lineage of Come In, Spinner and Bob and Up, probably the two most famous books of that kind, and also the works of Catherine Susanna Pritchard. But I think it's fair to say that Mina Calthorpe never became a particularly famous Australian author. She's really quite an obscure figure, and there's really not a lot known about her life, except that she lived for the rest of her life in the Shire, in the Sutherland Shire, and she did write two more books. One was about internal power dramas, the struggles of the union movement, and then much later a book about a historical novel about Irish migrants to Australia. But in selecting this book for the classics, we were led by Fiona McFarlane, who had come across a copy of The Dye House, and really I think it's a classic example of resurrecting a truly lost book that actually has so much to recommend it.
I couldn't agree more, and I mentioned earlier that this has emerged as my favourite so far of the classics that we've revisited. Perhaps it's some of those biographical details that make me feel close to. I used to live in the Shire, and where I have lived recently and live now is very close to where the Dye House is set, which is in Sydney's Macdonald Town, very close to Newtown. A lot of people know Newtown quite well as a bit of a culture hub. But the Dye House's Macdonald Town is a very different place, and we have this really fantastic ensemble cast of people who work in and around the Dye House. And it would be impossible to give a brief synopsis of every single story that Mina Calthorpe brings into the umbrella of the Dye House and the people that come and go, but suffice to say we have, I think, another absolutely fantastic villain in Renshaw, the manager of the Dye House. We have two or three really fascinating stories in Patty's relationship with Renshaw, in Huey's treatment at the hands of Renshaw, and then just the various characters who come and grow within the Dye House's broader sphere. I barely know where to begin because each of these stories really fascinated me, but did either of you, Deborah, did you have a story that really jumped out and was that hooked you on the Dye House?
Well, not really. I mean, it's interesting to hear you mention all those characters because they're all very vivid. Mm. But one of the things that is so impressive about this novel is its technical accomplishment. And you've mentioned the term ensemble novel, which means it has a lot of characters. And it's not a terribly long novel, but it does have a large cast of characters. And it works by this shifting point of view that doesn't really allow us to connect with any particular character, keeps us a little bit distanced, but it also involves us in a lot of very interesting and very different stories that those characters represent. I find this an extraordinarily accomplished novel in that respect, and I think it's very hard to do. And it surprises me that this novel has been forgotten for so long, and thank goodness text has brought it back into being. You mentioned Bob and Up, or David mentioned Bob and Up, and it's true, this is very much in that cast of novel. I actually think this is a much better novel than Bob and Up, as much as I like that novel too. I think Dorothy Hewitt actually referred to that as a little bit naive, and there's no naivety here at all. It's a very, very carefully crafted novel, The Dye House. And it means, I'm taking a long while to answer your question, it means that we are asked to understand the full extent of what it means to be a worker in this premises. And all those workers are different. There's the older woman, Miss Merton, the office worker. There's the young female, Patty, who's a kind of victim of the older man, the powerful man, Renshaw. But Renshaw himself, who's the manager of the factory, he's a victim too. And what's so wonderful is the way Mina Calthorpe has allowed us to see the real implications of what it means to be trapped in this industrial machine that in which makes everyone a kind of a victim.
I'm going to confess again, I hated Renshaw from the moment I met him. I mentioned also, David, last month we had another absolutely fantastic villain in The Watchtowers, Felix, and I think Renshaw sort of stands alongside Felix in his villainy in my mind, but he's very much a different villain, and he's a bit of a bully boy boss in the way he really impacts these people's lives. And I was interested in your reflection there, Deborah, that he is a victim in his own way, because for me that really took it almost to the last page for me to see that. And I'm going to bring in the rather enigmatic character of Miss Merton here, because it was Miss Merton and her reflections back to him right at the fading moments of the book that let me see how Renshaw in his own way was defeated long before he began in this situation. What did we think about that? If I bring in Miss Merton, her character, because she's very interesting to me in this book.
Well, you know, she's Mina Calthorpe's proxy, I guess, in a sense. And she, I guess, it's interesting to me that she's probably the most sympathetic character, and yet we're also rather distanced from her emotionally. And she's like the moral compass, I guess, attached to this particular workplace. I agree with you that Renshaw is an absolute villain. But by the end, we do actually see that he is just as much brutalized by this hierarchical world, that everyone's really gripped in some form of servitude, even if they're management like him or whether they're a floor worker.
I think that's right, and I think that's what makes one of the things that makes this novel so special is that if we look at the tradition of social realism, and in America the most obvious example is Upton Sinclair, the novels are often very grey and drab, and this one is so shrewd about keeping our attention. It's partly because we get the private lives of each of these characters in the ensemble cast, and it's partly because there are sympathies with people at every level in the hierarchy, and Miss Merton is both inside that hierarchy and a sort of distant observer of it, and she has her sympathies can travel upwards as well as downwards to the lowest level of workers, and everyone is getting screwed in the system to some extent.
I resisted, Deborah, you mentioned the idea of Miss Merton as Mina Calthorpe's proxy, and I resisted trying to over-familiarise myself with that idea, because I did find it so enigmatic, and I was really struck as the novel ended how we seemed to have come full circle. In the opening we have this figure of Miss Merton, very solitary. It's cinematic almost. I could see her emerging almost sort of black and white with the steam around her as she approaches the dye house, and we end with Miss Merton, this solitary figure, but very much changed, her consciousness changed. And as I said, it was only her reflections towards the end that helped me have any sympathy towards Renshaw. And I wondered how much I could take from Miss Merton. Her love story, Mina Calthorpe takes us back into Miss Merton's past with this love story, which is so utterly tragic, but still maintains this enigma juxtaposed with the romances that seem to happen in the dye house. We have Paddy and Gwenny and their dealings with Renshaw. And I keep coming back to this idea of enigma, and I'm not making any point whatsoever about it, because Miss Merton really sat outside of the other characters in the ensemble for that reason.
Yes, I think she has a kind of immunity, in a sense, to a lot of the political and indeed emotional issues that affect the other characters. Not that she's unemotional. Of course, you mentioned, you know, the tragedy in her life, and I think that's very important. She's a very, very good example of the kind of woman and female character that you had to have at this time, because women had to work. You know, this is a period that Calthorpe is describing as a time in transition. It's before social welfare. It's when women were very much circumscribed by who they are, and what they could do was very limited. So someone like Miss Merton has to work, but we're never invited to feel pity for her, I think, which is very interesting. We see her dignity, we see her control, we see that, yep, she has to work because she's got to maintain herself, but she's not abject in that role. Whereas the character of Patty is so much more a victim, I think, and we do feel sorry for her, as well as we feel she's rather stupid and kind of causing her own problems. And I feel, you know, I want to take her out and just give her a little bit of a good talking to, as far as Red is concerned, because she just doesn't see him at all.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3, and you're in the Aussie Classics Book Club. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm speaking with David Winter from Text Publishing and Deborah Adelaide. We are discussing Mina Calthorpe's The Dye House. Now, before we get back to that discussion, we might take a track, and because we are talking about the streets of my town, The Dye House is set in and around Sydney's inner west, I thought we'd take a little bit of a classic track. This is, of course, The Go-Betweens with The Streets of Your Town.
Yeah.
You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft Time, books, writing and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel. We just heard a track there from the Go-Betweens, an absolute Australian classic, The Streets of Your Town. And speaking of Australian classics, we are discussing Mina Calthorpe's The Die House. This is the Australian Classics Book Club. I am joined by David Winter and Deborah Adelaide. As much as the action of The Die House centres around what happens on the Die House floor and the lives of each of the workers, and we take the workers home, we get to visit into their homes, I saw so much of the action as occurring the inner lives and the progress that's made in them. And Paddy was a character that I thought, along with Gwenny, I absolutely loved for that journey that they went on. I loved when Gwenny Renshaw, our villain, is trying to have his way with her, and he's justifying it to himself in the most awful way, and she whacks him with a rock. And Paddy's realization is so much slower, but really all the more triumphant when we get to that moment where she can actually, and a really action-packed moment in the book, where she can actually just say nonchalantly no to Renshaw. This isn't going any further. With Miss Merton, though, I feel like I'm jumping over so much action, but this is an idea that's been plaguing me. The story's conclusion, it was something of a puzzle, because what we haven't mentioned yet, we have a big shift in the power dynamic in the Die House, brought about by Oliver and Barney. They've brought up a committee and the workers are organising. But Miss Merton's summarily dismissed, and it looks almost like a defeat for her. But as she's reflecting on this, you see in those last paragraphs this steely resolve seeming to form in her. And I wanted your take on that, both Deborah and David, because I wondered, was this sort of a nascent feminism that we could almost see Miss Merton going out and taking part in marches, where we're still in the late 50s here? But I it was so curious, and I'd love your ideas on this.
I certainly think it's the formation of a distinct kind of political sensibility. You know, it's a move towards socialism. It's a response to the unionisation on the shop floor, but also it's a response to mechanisation. I mean, in the dreariest terms, this novel is about or takes place during the overtaking of a very manual process that is undertaken by individuals with very discrete and developed skills by a factory, you know, by a system, and which is represented by figures who are remote in boardrooms, who are bean counters essentially. And Miss Merton seems to walk away, I think, very very defiantly, and with a sense that, you know, the day will come for those who deserve to get theirs.
What about your impressions, Deborah? Because I'm still just struck by this idea that on the one hand we have the workers almost celebrating a victory with their organisation, but Miss Merton is still outside of that.
Yes, it's true, and I think the ending is rather ambiguous. But just to get back to this,
there's a book
novel.
Too. Yeah.
One of the reasons I, because I read this years ago, and then I reread it last year, more recently. And I was really struck by just how accomplished the novel is. Mm. Technically, it's an amazing work of art, and also how strong a political novel is without seeming to push any particular political views. She just very quietly lets all these quite different characters expose themselves, and without sort of leaping in, preaching or bashing the reader around the head or trying to educate us, she allows this situation to speak for itself. And what it says is really very compelling and sad. And it says something about the brutality of this world in which all these human beings are just parts of this grim machine. And that's what is so impressive about her as a writer, because, you know, the social realist novel can bring out the worst in writers, you know. The tendency to preach and try and convert the reader is always there and sometimes hard to resist. But she does it brilliantly in this novel. And, as I said, I think rather better than Dorothy Hewett does in Bobbin Up.
It really does take a deft hand if we think about it, because I think as a reader we tend to want to identify in some way with a character and maybe project ourselves forward into that character. I mean, I definitely found myself vacillating between different characters that I was, you know, rooting for. But if it's not, as I said, dealt with a deft hand, then you tend to forget or not be interested, and you lose interest when your character's not centre stage. Mm. And in an ensemble cast, your character doesn't get that much time if you're really rooting for just one person.
Well, this is
it works because there's so much action because of the focus.
Absolutely, yeah.
The pace of the novel is really brisk, so we're just sort of given these very vivid, intimate scenes. And some of them are really moving. Like the character we haven't mentioned is the older man grappling with his wife's very unexpected pregnancy. Is Huey, I think, is it?
That's Barney. Barney and Huey, both the older men that are sort of grappling. But yeah, Barney with his wife's pregnancy.
I mean, all that is very intimate and moving, but the pace is so brisk. We're moving along all the time, and we see it very vividly. I think you mentioned cinematic, and I agree that's exactly the right term. You could actually see this as you read.
Mm, I found it was such a visual novel, and it really struck me the way there are so many things to talk about how visual this novel is, but also the juxtaposition. You mentioned how grey the atmosphere can be, and you can imagine the factories being very grey and dour places. And then we're in the dye house, and then there's these splashes of vivid colour that are so wonderfully realised.
Yes. And there's a lot of amazing detail about the dyeing process. I mean, you could learn all about it if you wanted to. There's so much detail about that.
Technical and intricate, because Mina Calthorpe actually put herself in a position where she had to juxtapose the learned sort of on-the-job training of Huey versus Renshaw's technical training. And so she's really putting herself in two different sets of shoes to talk about this one skill.
Yeah, that she can describe intimately the work that is being done in the Dye House and also give us all these characters' private lives and do this by cutting in from short chapter to short chapter and never leave us feeling that it's too abrupt but rather that it's all seamless is just astonishing, really, and it's why it's such a clever and involving novel.
I might be drawing a long bow here, but we have been talking a lot about the ensemble cast and how well it works in Mina Calthorpe's hands. And I know this book has, I guess, a level of obscurity. It was perhaps never as famous as we might want it to be. But how much has the legacy of an ensemble cast played forward into Australian narrative storytelling? I mean, you don't have to go very far to think of Home and Away and Neighbours. Maybe not the best comparisons to make, but we do tend to love this ensemble cast and this rich community of characters.
I'd like to comment on that, but not having got into Neighbours and Home and Away, I'm not sure if you are drawing a long bow or not.
I'm definitely drawing a long bow, but I still just find it fascinating, this idea that we seem to love an ensemble cast. And Mina Calthorpe, was ahead of her time in that sense with the Dye House.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you've just referred to TV shows, and previously we were talking about how cinematic the book is, and so our references are sort of a little bit outside literary fiction, really. We're thinking about how visual this book is and how it can have so many characters that you can follow and care about or loathe or whatever, which suggests that, it was pretty ahead of its time.
I've also spent an enormous amount of time reading into it from my perspective in 2017. And another moment, another cinematic but very Sydney moment, was Oliver and Patty as they are looking forward to their future and discussing the terrace where they're living. And I could only imagine the millions of dollars that terrace is worth now. And they have a discussion about renovating a terrace, which just could not be more 2017. We are talking about The Dye House by Mina Calthorpe. You're in the Australian Classics Book Club on Final Draft. I want to thank both of my fellow book club members today. David Winter is a senior publisher at Text. Thank you, David.
Thanks so much, Andrew and Deborah.
And Deborah Adelaide, she is a novelist, a writer, and academic. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us in what was a fantastic discussion today.
Oh, thank you, Andrew, and thank you, David, and for Text Classics.
There are so many more in the Text Classic range, and you can keep joining us every month for a new look back into Australian classic literature.
My mind has just been blown.
2SCR.com.
A lot of people who've been injured in accidents don't get legal advice about compensation because they're afraid of what it will cost. But the truth is, it doesn't need to cost you anything. A specialist injury lawyer could actually fund your case for you. Law Partners is Australia's largest specialist personal injury firm, and it costs nothing to call their local office to get some advice. Call Law Partners on 133 529 or visit lawpartners.com.au.
2SER sponsors.
You're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, although it's almost over, only a few minutes left. My name's Andrew Popel. Thank you so much for joining me. It was Australian Classics Book Club. The last Saturday of every month, we bring in an Australian classic to discover or rediscover. This month, it was The Dye House from Mina Calthorpe. If you are reading along and you want to get ready for the July Book Club, we will be talking about Wake in Fright from Kenneth Cook. There is a new adaptation in the works, so this is definitely one to get on top of. Now, do not go anywhere. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next. If you missed anything today, get over to 2SER.com. You can listen back at any time. Thank you so much for joining me. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'll be back next week with more books, writing, and literary culture. See you then.